The Initial Reaction Podcast is back. I'm J.R. Radcliffe from Lake Country Publications and Now Newspapers. I am joined by my partner in crime, my best friend in the whole world, J.P. Kadoran of Spectrum Sports. Hi, J.P.
Hi, buddy. I never know where you're going with that. I always get nervous about what you want me to say.
I don't know. What I didn't intend for you to say anything. I'm just happy you're here, J.P.
Well, then I will remain silent until you need my services.
All right. Sounds good. I do need your services this moment because here's what we want to talk about today. First of all, I sat down with Evan Krasinski. He is formerly of Franklin High School. He was drafted by the evil St. Louis Cardinals in the ninth round of the Major League Baseball draft last week. So even though the Cardinals are evil, Evan Krasinski's cool. And chatted with him about his days at East Carolina. Had a fascinating career. Great interview. I love talking to the guy. That's going to come up later in the podcast. We will talk about him. He's going to be at Peoria. By the time you hear this, he's going to be in Peoria pitching a ball for the Cardinals organization. So things are going to move along quickly. The Peoria Chiefs. I was going to say that, but then I thought I wasn't sure. Is it the Chiefs? I don't want to say that and be wrong.
Yep, it's totes the Chiefs. They will be playing against the Timber Rattlers in Appleton on August 21st, 22nd.
How do you know that? Because you're going to go talk to him.
There you go.
Beautiful. Great interview. I swear, though, he pitches at East Carolina. I swear he somewhere along the way picked up the Southern accent. And you can hear this when I talk to him. He's got a very deep voice. And I was like, am I talking to a guy who's from the South? Or is this really the kid from Franklin High School?
Where is East Carolina?
It's in Carolina, of course.
I don't learn North and South.
Yes, well, that's because those are the actual states, and East Carolina isn't a state. It is in Greenville, South Carolina, home of the NCAA tournament this past year. Am I right?
That's where I just was.
You could have hung out with them
3 months ago.
Yeah.
Wow. Little did I know.
Now, is East Carolina the host at Greenville? I don't remember for sure.
I believe maybe they were. I think it was hosted by Furman.
That could be, yeah. It could be a really small school.
Furman and the Big South is, I believe, who hosted. And that was the one that got moved from Greensboro, North Carolina. So there, it was complicated.
Yes, that is true. Now, wait. Am I wrong about it? It's Greenville, North Carolina. So that's not where the NCAA tournament. East Carolina is in Greenville, North Carolina.
That's crazy. No, I went to Greenville, South Carolina.
Whoa. Oh, my gosh. Can't they be like Wisconsin and just have all these 40-syllable town names so they'd be easy to tell apart?
My mind is blown today.
That is crazy. Yeah, we need to learn a little more about our geography on the East Coast. But got sidetracked. Also want to talk today a lot about the U.S. Open, which was at Erin Hills, as many of you know, in the town of Erin. Went seemingly very, very well. J.P. Kadoran was there 3 days out of the week and wanted to get his thoughts. But before we do that, it is a big week for your Milwaukee Bucks. There is a draft coming up on Thursday night where the Bucks will take the next piece of their future, presumably. And there is a new GM in town. John Horst was announced as the general manager at a press conference on Monday. That news broke a few days prior. And then Greg Monroe, it was announced, is going to opt in to his third year of the contract and be back with the Bucks next year. A newsy week to be a Bucks fan. But JP, what does it all mean?
Means a few things. Where do you even want me to start?
Let's start with the general manager, because that is the most controversial of these items. It is thought there was a management disagreement as to which direction to go there.
Yeah, and it's only an interesting decision or a storyline is because of that dissension and because he supposedly wasn't part of their first, initial six or three finalists. But the actual hire itself isn't a problem at all. I mean, he is a well-regarded up-and-coming star in the league who's been with the Bucks for 8-9 years ever since John Hammond was here in 2008. So, and I talked to him yesterday, after a Bucks pre-draft workout. He's awesome. The only problem is just the process of how they got him, which I keep bringing up. Do you remember that there was a process on how they brought Jason Kidd here with firing Larry Drew and hiring Jason Kidd, even though they had said they were committed to him?
Unquestionably, that was a thing.
Yeah, but now nobody remembers that. They just remember that Jason Kidd is a coach. So it was a thing of how he was hired, but based on what I know after talking to him yesterday, it shouldn't be a thing because he's probably the right guy for the job.
I would agree with you. It doesn't bother me that some leaders have a disagreement about which direction to go with an organization. That makes a lot of sense. And in fact, I think can be very healthy for an organization.
Yeah, that's probably good.
Yeah, when you've got, you're forced to hash out differences. I think one of the things I remember with Jason Kidd is he was seen he was the guy, their guy, the new owner's guy that they brought in, whether or not he had the acumen to hold the position. Obviously things have worked out well for the most part. I know that was sort of on the table, and it's surprising to me that the, you know, management would have disagreement about the direction, but I think it's healthy. It's obviously going to be all baked into the results. If the Bucks take the step forward that everyone thinks they're going to, no one will remember or care. And if he doesn't, oh, the Bucks organization is a mess. They couldn't come up with a good GM. I mean, the candidates themselves, this is speaking as somebody who doesn't follow the NBA as closely as many people who would know those names. It wasn't like there were a bunch of who's who names on there that you know from other places. They were mostly, you know, they were up and coming guys, assistant GMs and stuff. It's like when David Stearns was hired with the Brewers. Well, nobody knew who he was, but we weren't, you know, he's fine, up and coming guy, and just give him a chance to see what he does.
You've been on the team for, like I said, since 2008. He's been involved with the salary cap, which now is going to be an issue because of Greg Rowe. He's been involved in all of this. Like, he's ready to go. You know, he is part of the younger crowd, of the analytics crowd. I think that definitely applies more to baseball than it does to basketball, but he's ready. I mean, he's been doing this for a long time, not as long as a 50-year-old or 60-year-old whose life's work is tied up in basketball, but he's ready to go.
You can correct
and,
me.
Oh, go and ahead. Sorry, with the draft coming up, you know, tomorrow now, it's good that it's an internal candidate because of all the workouts and everything that they had. I mean, if you had somebody come in from the outside, you wouldn't have had that range of picks and of knowledge of the workouts that the Bucks have had. So it's even better that it's an internal candidate.
You can correct me if I'm wrong, because again, I don't know a lot about the analytics of the NBA. I trust that there is some value to them, and maybe this has nothing to do with the analytics, but it seems to me in recent years, either this is just me or fans or announcers more acutely aware of how players work together on the floor. It's not about having the best player at each position. It's more about spacing and more about, okay, and this ties into Greg Monroe, who in his first year, they couldn't find the right fit for him. It wasn't working out. His defensive capabilities weren't meshing with the other players on the floor. And then last year, it seems to me, or presumably, there was some sort of revelation as to how to best use him, bring him off the bench, and he was in lineups where he could be very effective, and he was unquestionably one of the best players for the Bucks last year, a huge asset to what the Bucks were doing last year. I don't know if that's analytics or just sort of, maybe that's always been part of the game and I just haven't been aware of it. But it seems like that's something that is important for the Bucks as they sort of try to find these right combinations, because they have the stars. They have the star, and then they have players who can be the star on any given night. Now it's about finding the right rotations and the right mix that is going to let everybody bring their best to the table.
Yeah, rotations is what I was going to say. It's about who you're being paired with and who you're going against on the other teams too. I mean, that's one of the reasons that Monroe was so good coming off the bench, is because then, you know, 6, 7, 8 minutes into the game, he was going up against the other team's second best group of players. So it's about fit and rotations and who can fit a long-term view of this franchise, because you have to assume Greg Monroe will not be here after next season, because he has this $18 million contract going into 17-18 season. Then after that, I mean, I would assume that they think Thon Maker is going to take over as their next big man inside. So yeah, you're right. It's all about fit. I don't think that's a new thing, but I just think now there are numbers to go along with it.
Jumping off what you said there with Thon Maker, it's pretty exciting that Monroe will be here for that bridge year, so to speak, when, you know, you got to think Thon Maker's going to be a ton better in year three than year one and year two. Were you surprised, though, that Monroe opted in to come back for a third year?
No, because $18 million is a lot of money.
So much
centers,
money.
Centers are being devalued in today's NBA, so he was not getting anywhere near that on a yearly basis if you were to take a 2 or 3 year deal. So, nope, collect one more big paycheck and then go out and get a couple smaller ones in the coming years. Even though, like, he's not that old. Like, everybody just thinks he is because he's got that low voice and he seems like a traveled veteran. He's not old. I think he's 27. But the fact remains that if he were to take a different contract this year, it would be something like 3 years and maybe 12, 13, maybe 14 million. But why not put that off one more year and get an $18 million year in there? So I know I would do it.
Oh, so would I. I would do it for 1 million because I am just that nice of a guy. I don't know if it would make you more interesting or less interesting at cocktail parties if you understood the contract machinations and salary machinations of the NFL, NBA, Major League Baseball. I mean, because Greg Monroe can make more money with the Bucks than he can with other teams, and there's exemptions and various other things, and it's all so convoluted, and it is such a difficult thing to explain. But that is very much, you know, very much in play. Is it still the case, to your understanding, though, that there will be more money to work with for all teams going forward because of the way the salary cap is working now, and that it isn't going to be as big a hit as maybe it would have been in past years to have Monroe back on the roster?
Yeah, I mean, that's already happened to some degree, especially with, was it Chris Middleton? Yeah, Chris Middleton's contract that we looked at as enormous at 5 years and $14 million, and then the new salary cap hit, and he is one of the biggest bargains in the NBA at $14 million. So, no, the TV money is coming in, the salary caps are going up, and numbers that have already hit a couple of years ago aren't what they're going to be this year and beyond. Correct.
Bucks are in an enviable position with the draft coming up. There are no definite needs that they have to address. Probably we'll be looking at a player for the, I wouldn't say distant future, but definitely not the immediate future. Would anything surprise you on draft night? Is there anything that do you have any expectations whatsoever, I guess, is the better question.
Probably if like certain players slip necessarily, but right now the way the draft is shaking out is that there's going to be a ton of guards taken in the first, you know, like 10 picks, like that's just what the draft is. The 10 best players are mostly guards, and then after that, it's mostly big men. So basically, everybody is expecting the Bucks to have big men available when they pick and for them to take another big man, which is getting a bit exhausting of just getting another lengthy power forward who they want to be an outside shooter. Like that story is getting a bit old. Save for Rashad Vaughn, that's kind of been their story over and over and over.
Right.
But I think that's kind of what's going to happen again. I don't think, personally, I don't see a trade happening. I just don't think they have a lot of movable pieces. I think they have a lot of players they like, and the players they don't like probably can't be moved. So I don't see a trade happening. I see them keeping the 17th pick and probably taking another big guy.
Do you have any sense if the new general manager will change some of the valuation of the current players? Like maybe is Thon Maker more available than he might have been under John Hammond, things like that? Because this isn't the guy who necessarily drafted any of the players on the roster. But then again, he's been with the organization for this long. Yeah. You presume he's part of it.
That's a good question about the valuation of certain players. I don't know the answer to that. I don't think anything's going to change in terms of the draft process, though. I mean, Horst was so involved with these picks for so long. He had said yesterday that John Hammond gave him lots of autonomy when it came to certain player decisions. So I don't think things are going to change that much. I don't see their view changing that much. And I think also with the 17th pick, you kind of take whatever's there. You don't have the luxury of targeting certain positions or certain players because there are 16 other ones ahead of you.
All right, well, the Bucks will make their selection sometime in the evening, Thursday night, so that'll be something to watch for. Wasn't the only draft going on in the past few weeks or in this 2 to 3 week window. The MLB draft took place in the early part of June, and we had a few local players who were taken. Ryan Horter, I think, of Kenosha Indian Trail, might have been the only current high school player who was ultimately drafted. There were some guys that we thought might get taken. Austin Jones, UW-Whitewater, formerly Wauwatosa West, wasn't taken. Griffin Dorshing of Greendale was a possibility. But like I said, we got this interview with Evan Krasinski, formerly of Franklin and East Carolina University, coming up. He has signed with the St. Louis Cardinals. That'll be next on the list. But first, JP, the U.S. Open golf tournament came and went. People loved it. The rain held off for the most part. There was some showers early in the week, but everybody, there weren't any real delays in the play. Everybody seems to be loving it, JP. I don't know how you feel about it. You were there. Was it really as great as it was as cracked up to be? I mean, did this really come through with flying colors like it seems to have?
I think that's a very complicated question. I think for the most part, yes. The USGA fit, they sold 30,000 tickets every day. They fit every corporate hospitality tent in the world onto the course. And they got a heck of a contract from Fox. So from the USGA's perspective, What everything boils down to is money, and from that perspective, it was amazing. The USGA did not have any sort of rules violations being called in to affect Sunday drama. They did not have greens that looked like you were playing whack-a-mole on top of it with all the bumps that were coming out of nowhere. So I think from a USGA drama standpoint, it was also a success. The problem people are having is quite obviously that the scores were too low for some people, that they didn't want to see the U.S. Open, which is supposedly the toughest test in golf, go that low to be 16 under for the winning score, which I think has some merit to it. I mean, I'm about to shoot it down and just destroy it, but I think there's some merit. You don't want to see a score that low, but there are countless other examples. I don't know where to start. There are countless other examples of other tournaments that have been that low that have had no problem at all. I just was reminded that Tiger won at St. Andrews, at the old course at St. Andrews, at 19 under back in 2000. You know, I'm pretty sure that course has
Tiger
still held
Woods
up.
Tiger Woods was really good, though.
He was, and guess what? Brooks Koepka was really good for 4 days. The problem is, if it's Spieth against Jason Day at 16 against 12 under, then people have no problem with it. The problem is that it was Brooks Koepka against Brian Harman.
Oh, word. Yeah, I agree with that.
And because of that, that's the reason that the scores are a problem, is because they were, quote, no-name golfers going for it.
But how – and so how fascinating that you've got the – it's so mitigated, the fact that scores were low, by the fact that the top golfers in the world really struggled the first 2 days, and so many of them didn't even make the cut. Jordan Spieth was out of the running even though he made the cut. And so – it's so weird. Like, how do you evaluate it? It isn't even just Koepka and Harmon. Outside of Ricky Fowler, had we heard of any of the golfers? I mean, Hideki Matsuyama, we sort of know. For the most part, these are all guys that nobody has ever heard of. There's all these dudes that you've never heard before on your TV screen on Sunday. And that's not the fault of anything other than that's just who played it. And I would totally agree that the scores were too low, even though I feel like it's kind of a crazy balancing act. And it was a par 72, which we don't always see. So the overall scores weren't that much lower than what we've seen in past opens. But, I just don't know what to make of it. Like, the best players in the world were not good at it. So why was everybody else? I don't know.
Yeah, I think first of all, the par thing, you know, so Koepka won with a score of 272. 288 is the par. 72 times 4 is 288. He won 16 under, so he was 272. The average of the past five U.S. Opens, I think, was 274. So, like, it wasn't that different. It was just we called it something different. It was the same amount of strokes. We just called it something different.
Right.
The course wasn't any easier or harder. Again, it was just different. I think... the top three players in the world missed the cut. Eight of the top 12 missed the cut. So you were missing some names, obviously. But, like, I don't understand why that wasn't viewed as a good thing. Like, I don't understand why the top seven guys of the leaderboard all trying for their first major, I don't understand how that's not unbelievably compelling, that somebody's out there trying to join that club. Like, you're almost guaranteeing somebody's going to join that club. When Justin Thomas was destroying the course on Saturday, everybody loved it. He shot a 63, 9 under. Everybody loved it. And he was one of those no-name guys. But then all of a sudden on Sunday, we have to hear how nobody's in the race. Like, wait, 24 hours ago, the country was in love with this guy.
Right.
So a lot of people overreacting without even realizing what they're saying, which is kind of dumb.
Yeah, I don't. It's not the fault of the course who's in the running. I did, as a guy who's not a huge golf fan but who follows it a little bit, I found myself gravitating towards Ricky Fowler. Oddly enough, even though all of these other stories are probably better, I found myself at the end wanting Ricky Fowler to be in the mix. And I think just from a drama perspective, not caring really who wins, I wanted to see a playoff. I wanted to see it come down to the final hole. Anytime that doesn't happen, regardless of who's in the race, that's a little disappointing. But certainly that has nothing to do with Aaron Hills. Now, if you want to say the course was a touch too easy, you can. I don't think that's something that's going to get fixed. The fairways being as wide as they are is probably the main reason for that. I did think it was sort of funny that the fescue issue early in the week, which was supposedly maybe too hard, ended up being completely a non-issue because obviously guys were able to get double-digit scores under par. But I don't think there's a way to make Aaron Hills markedly more difficult necessarily. And I guess Is that something people remember, that a course plays easily or difficult in a particular major tournament? There's no tournament that I can remember precisely whether or not I thought the course played too difficult or too hard. It's just, you know, you remember the guy who wins. That's what you remember at the end of the day.
Yeah, and this is a guy that won his first major. So in theory, it should be a great story. I mean, Jason Day was celebrated as winning his first major from the PGA, and nobody really commented
awesome.
On that. Yeah, so
right.
I don't know. It's just a lot of people talking in circles, I think.
Yeah. So for you, it wasn't a problem that there were some interesting items that arose from the tournament. There was a blimp that crashed. None of this is the fault of Aaron Hills, an elderly spectator who passed away. And then also, was there some E. coli on one hole something like that? I mean, those things had the potential to derail the conversation a little bit. It doesn't really seem like that's what happened.
No, I mean, so a few things there. So the E. coli thing happened on one hole. The USGA caught it. It's not because anybody got sick, and they fixed it, and I believe still nobody got sick. The blimp crash was not the US Open's blimp. It did not crash on their property. That was not a story. It just, now the local stations ran with it because it's sensational, but it's not a story. The fan who passed away, turns out I actually know a girl, it was her great uncle, and the USGA has come out, and I didn't know that, and the USGA has come out with like a really touching feature about it. I think the journal Sentinel wrote an article on it. Like, it's as sad as it is, it's actually like
it's a
really good
story.
And again, it had nothing to do with the course based on everything you read. It wasn't because of the heat. It wasn't because of, you know, a strenuous course or anything like that. So no, there were lots of little things that didn't matter that we know because we're in the media in Milwaukee, and this is our job to pay attention to these things and report on these things. But for everybody else, I just can't imagine that it's a story.
Yeah, I'm not going to poo-poo the idea of a blimp crashing not being a story. It has nothing to do with Aaron Hills or the USGA, but it's, you know, it's at the US Open and kind of a harrowing escape situation. So like, that's interesting to me. I want to know more about it, but yeah, it sounds like everything for the most part went smoothly. I think the one thing people were nervous about going into it was the traffic situation. Everybody gets bussed in from afar. You can't just show up at the US Open. You have to be, participate in a park and ride of some sort, and that seemed to work great. It seems like the buses were constantly moving. There were no waits. There were no backups. It sounds like everything went swimmingly.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Everything that could have been a problem wasn't a problem. I don't know. I think the U.S. Open is booked until 2026, and I'm sure Aaron Hills is one of their top choices for 2027. So I'm planning on it coming back. Because again, back to the very first thing I said, they made a buttload of money.
Yeah, they did. And that is, in fact, what all that matters. And yeah, we might be going through the same 8-year period again between getting the announcement and the actual event itself. It seems like it's been forever, but very cool that the U.S. Open was in the state of Wisconsin. All eyes on the state for the time being. Let's jump over to baseball. The MLB draft took place last week. Handful of players, as I said, were taken from area schools, area alumni. One of them, Evan Krasinski of Franklin High School, the 9th round selection of the St. Louis Cardinals. He's a left-handed pitcher from East Carolina University. I sat down, I just called him up on the phone, and here we chatted. Take a listen. My guest is Evan Krasinski, formerly of Franklin High School. He pitched at East Carolina and is now a member of the St. Louis Cardinals baseball organization. He was drafted in the 9th round last week, and now his pro career is underway. And that's where I want to start, Evan. Tell me what the last few days have been like for you. I know you had to sign a contract. It sounds like you're already on the move. You're in Florida, but you're going to be elsewhere. What's the itinerary for you going ahead here?
Yeah, it's been a little hectic the first 2 days, you know, getting the physicals done, and, you know, I broke my leg this year at ECU, so just checking that out and making sure it's all good to go, which it is. So now it's just getting ready for, they're sending me to Class A Peoria, so I'm down here in Jupiter. They're on their all-star break in Peoria, so now I'm just throwing down here. I'm going to face live hitting tomorrow, and then they'll probably shit me out Wednesday, and I'll jump right into the rotation in Peoria.
Dang, that is fast. And a lot of guys obviously get drafted if they're out of high school or early in their college career. They're going to go to rookie ball, so they get to ease in a little bit. But not you, huh? They want you right in the fire at A-ball. That's going to be an interesting adjustment.
Yeah, I'm excited. You know, it actually helped me breaking my leg. As bad as it sounds, it actually helped me breaking my leg this year at school. So actually, I don't have too many innings under my belt yet this year, so they said I can basically just go have a full half a season at Class A.
Yeah, that's interesting. And if I recall, you broke your leg because you got hit by a comebacker. I want to say that was in March or something. So tell me about the injury and coming back from that. You had some success right away, and then you know hit some rough patches. I'm curious to know if that was partially because of the injury. Like how would you sort of describe what happened to you and if that impacted you the rest of the way?
Yeah, you know, I got off to an okay start to begin the year. You know, I pitched all right at Ole Miss and had a pretty bad start against LaSalle, but mm-hmm. You know, I was still working on some stuff, and you know, it was also a really good start against Western Carolina. You know, there's those days where you know that you have your stuff, and that was one of them. And, you know, I'm facing the third batter of the first inning, and I throw him a 0-1 breaking ball. It was down and away. Wasn't expecting him to get much barrel on it. And he squared it up pretty good, and I blocked it with my left leg, wow. Ankle area, and kicked away. I ran after it and made the play. And, I limped off the field and fell to the ground in the training room. And the funny thing is, I was joking around, not really joking at the time, but I was like, panting. I'm like, I just broke my leg.
Oh,
and they're all laughing. And, you know, I was kind of laughing off because I truly didn't think I broke it.
Right.
So I actually went out to pitch two more innings and probably shouldn't have because I gave up a 3-run home run one of the few pitches before I came out. But I knew something wasn't right, and I took the next couple of days off and then tried getting back up and still couldn't. So we waited until the following Thursday to get an x-ray, and
yeah. And
you could see that it was broken. So, you know, it was devastating. You know, I chose to come back for my senior year, but
right.
That wasn't the only reason was for baseball. You know, was get close to my degree and, you know, finish out the career that I started with all the seniors that I was with. But I mean, it did kill my spirit when I found out it was broken, and the doc said I'd probably be out 6 to 8 weeks. And, you know, it's in college baseball, that's a big chunk of the season.
Right.
And I knew that'd be part of the conference season. So, you know, I stayed positive with it. I didn't want to let other teammates see me be negative and bring them down with me. But, you know, that's when our season started to spiral a little bit. And, you know, like when I got back, we were 0-10 in conference.
Jeez.
And, you know, this is after being preseason ranked 6th in the country. And to see the downfall we're on is tough. And, you know, I tried my best to get the team headed back in the right direction. But, you know, first start back was a little jittery. And, the second start back was against Cincinnati where I pitched pretty well. One
right.
of my best starts at East Carolina. And after that, I was doing too much too fast. You know, I probably shouldn't have thrown 8 innings that start, but, you know, I begged to stay in, and they wanted to take me out, but I told them I was staying in the game because I wanted to get us that first conference win, and I did so. And, you know, it was tough for my arm to catch back up after that, and, you know, I battled the rest of the way out, and I gave the coaching staff everything I had.
Right.
And, you know, I tried to be the guy who I was the year before. And you know, I couldn't really get back to the guy that I was. But, you know, I did what I did. And I go out there and compete every time and try to give us a chance to win the ball game.
And through the diagnosis and then having those struggles you did so close, you know, as you closed the season, what were you thinking about your draft position? Were you concerned that this is going to take a toll on where you ultimately fell? And then when you went in the 9th round, I guess, what was your reaction to that?
Yeah, throughout college, I think what made me successful is I didn't worry about the draft.
Yeah.
You know, junior year, I wasn't expecting anything, and that's why I was so successful. I wasn't worried about outside things that I couldn't control. I controlled what I could control, and that was pitching and giving ECU a chance to win the game, and that's why we got to a super region that year. It's because we were a bunch of guys that didn't worry about anything but giving East Carolina our best chance, and that's what we did. And you know, that's what I did my whole career. So even when the injury happened, I didn't worry about the draft. I worried about me not being able to be out there on Friday night pitching for ECU, And for it being my last year, you know, just missing the start. So my focus every day was, you know, just rehab as hard as possible and as tough as possible just so I could get back out there and try to get us some wins. And, you know, we were that close in the conference championship to advancing, and that's all I was focusing on. I wasn't focusing on the draft. And,
yeah.
You know, once that final out was made and our season was over, that's when I finally, you know, just took a step back and started thinking, all right, let's see where I can go in the draft. And some teams called, and you know, I had an idea, but it really didn't matter to me. I just wanted to start to play professional baseball, and that's what I got.
Right. Yeah, and I do want to talk about that super regional that you mentioned from your junior year, but now that you have a chance to sit back and reflect and are a member of the Cardinals, were they one of the teams that was most involved, or did their selecting you come as a bit of a surprise?
It was very much a surprise. You know, I didn't talk to them at all in the fall and not much at all in the spring. And the morning of day two of the draft, I got a text from T.C. Calhoun, the area scout, and he just let me know. He said, hey, man. Watch for your name today. I'm gonna give you a call
that's awesome.
If I can make it happen. And you know, it started to go down, and he gave me a call to start the ninth round. Said, hey, look for your name right here, and it happened. And it was the greatest feeling in the world.
That's great. That is really cool. So speaking of greatest feeling in the world, you had a pretty good showing in the Super Regional yourself in Texas, where you got East Carolina. I think that put you up 1-0. And then ended up losing the series 2-1. What was that experience like? I know that there was a push to get East Carolina to Omaha for the first time, and it didn't happen there. But just, I mean, where does that rank in terms of baseball memories for you?
That's 100% up there at number one. You know, going to UVA and the regional and knocking them off, and then advancing to Texas Tech, which is one of the most hostile environments in college baseball, and you know, just. Being once again, a team that was preseason not ranked, you know, just we went out there every day and we pride ourselves on being blue collar, and that's what Coach Godwin preaches. And you know, we didn't act like we were too small or who cares, like that they were the number five national seed. We just went out there and played our game, and you know, game one happened, and you know, they hit me in the mouth with the home run to take the lead in the fourth, but Travis Washington had my back like he did all 4 years at ECU. And not only was he a great catcher, but he hit the 3-run home run in the grand slam to drive in 7 runs in that first game. And then, you know, just to be 90 feet away 2 times on Saturday and not be able to drive the guy in. And,
yeah,
you know, it was heartbreaking, but, I mean, it was a weekend that I'll never forget for the rest of my life. Just the guys that were a part of that team and how tough those guys were and how they weren't afraid of anything. And, you know, that's just what East Carolina was all about,
right?
Being blue collar and not being fair to anybody and just wanting to give everyone your best will.
I'm curious to know what brought you out there in the first place. I imagine there are not many Wisconsin sports fans that have East Carolina on their radar. So what got you down to the East Coast?
You know, it's a college town, and I love that. You know, I feel like, there's a couple of big name schools that I had options to go to, but you know, every time I visited Greenville, I fell in love even more. And you know, after 4 years, I mean, there's a reason I returned for my senior year. I was in love with that place, the fans, the community, and how much they care about the baseball program and how much they care about you as a person. You know, I wouldn't trade those 4 years for anything. And the guys that I got to be around, the coaches that I got to learn from, you know. I saw all that when I was visiting these schools, and I saw how genuine, you know, Billy Godwin was the head coach that recruited me there. But even he was genuine about caring for me as a person. And then when Cliff Godwin stepped in, I knew he was the right guy for the job, just because how blue collar he was and how he played there back in 2001 when they made it to a super regional as well. And, I love the blue collar mentality and, you know, just going to work every day, knowing that you're not the best, but we're not afraid to beat the best.
Right. This is not uncommon for Division I pitchers in Wisconsin to miss most of their summer senior season because they need to report to college. They get started early.
Yep.
There's all sorts of responsibilities. How tough was that for you? Obviously, it ended up working out, you know, tremendously. But to have to miss your senior year at Franklin for the most part, still getting first team all GMC with half a season, which is pretty cool. But how difficult of a situation was that for you?
Yeah, it was tough. I'll never forget to talk to head coach Hughes and, you know, having to break that to him. He wasn't very happy, but he understood because he knew I was going out to play Division One baseball, and, you know, and he was a big reason why I was going out to play Division One baseball because he saw the talent in me my freshman year and allowed me to pitch 4 years for the varsity team. But, you know, it was tough. You know, the guys I grew up playing since I was about, 8 years old, and, you know, having to leave them early, but it's pretty funny. You might have to fact check this, but I believe they won 13 straight games.
Yeah, right after you left.
Yeah, something crazy like that after I left, and I think John Sulfur and Tyler Gentz shot me a text letting me know that they didn't need me anymore. So. Yeah,
I'm sure you were just superfluous at that point. No need for you.
Yeah, it's funny how it works, but no, I was following them along the whole way and giving those guys calls, telling them that they were still doing well, and I think they came up a game short of the state tournament, mm-hmm. but it was a heck of a run by the team that, Coach Hughes coached.
Yeah. So you played, you were actually pitching when, I think you're the winning pitcher when Hughes won his 800th career game. You got to play in two state tournaments as a freshman and sophomore. What, I'm imagining those are some of the memories you look back on your Franklin career. Those are some of the things that stand out. What do you remember from those state tournaments? What do you remember from your career at Franklin?
My career at Franklin was such a good one. You know, Coach Hughes being part of the first two state championships in Franklin history and just playing for Coach Hughes and all the accolades that he won while I was there. And, you know, just the day I'll never forget is when he gave me the ball in the sectional final against Oak Creek, you know, our rival. And we got to play in South Milwaukee in front of all those fans, and, mm-hmm. and he just let me know, he's like, hey, man, you're the right guy for the job. And, you know, we went out there and knocked Oak Creek off, and they said nobody was beating Oak Creek the rest of the way out that year. And, you know, as a sophomore, it was pretty crazy experience because I really didn't get to pitch much in playoffs as a freshman, but
right.
you know, knocking Oak Creek off and advancing to the state tournament only to go there and win it again. So
yeah, pretty sweet.
You know, just a bunch of great times at Franklin, and you know, all thanks to Coach Hughes for all the opportunities that he provided me with, and you know, just all the lessons that he taught me to carry over to college baseball, and now they're going to carry over to my professional career.
Excellent. Well, as Brewers fans, I'm not sure if we should be. I'm happy for you, and I'm sure the Franklin fans are happy for you. But you're the enemy now. We will still be following along, and I guess we'll cheer for you to do okay. I suppose we can find that in our hearts.
I really appreciate that.
All right, thanks a lot, Evan. Congratulations on everything, and good luck going forward.
Thank you,
JP. What do you have coming up on Spectrum Sports this week? I'm sure there's lots of U.S. Open in your future.
In my past,
well,
there's
in your past
some American
slash future.
Yes, there's some American Family Insurance Championship golf in my future. There's some IndyCar racing in my future. There is the State Baseball All-Star Games in Spectrum Sports' future this Friday afternoon as we will air those games live. So there is a lot of stuff still going on. The busiest two-week stretch in Wisconsin sports history continues.
We had a pretty busy stretch ourselves at Lake Country Publications and now newspapers when a full half of the 16 teams that qualified for the state soccer tournament were under our coverage footprint, in our coverage footprint. Some great stories to come out of it. We had state champions in all four divisions, Brookfield Central in D1, Whitefish Bay D2, Catholic Memorial for the sixth consecutive year in 3, Brookfield Academy in D4. You can check out state championship stories on mycommunitynow.com. Andrew Grumman, one of my colleagues, wrote a great story about a Brookfield Central player named Jenny Cape. She missed 6 months of the school year. She was sick with, I don't remember the exact name of the illness, but she basically, her body couldn't create new red blood cells. So she needed to be hospitalized. She needed some care, was able to do a lot of schoolwork from home, from her bed, but her immune system was weakened, so she couldn't go back to school. Finally gets to go back at the end of March. She is able to play soccer, wanted to play basketball. That didn't happen, but was able to play soccer. Then Brookfield Central is the number one team in the state. She scores 3 goals between the semifinal and the championship game. Central wins the gold ball. Phenomenal, phenomenal story. So you got to check that out at brookfieldnow.com.
Yeah. State soccer, state baseball, state softball has happened. Yeah, it is, again, part of the craziest 2 weeks we've ever had.
Yeah, so we're through the WIAA spring, though, for the most part, even though there are other things to note, including the Bucks draft. So where are you watching that on Thursday night?
From the Bucks Training Center in St. Francis.
Yeah.
This will be Probably seventh or eighth time I've spent my last Thursday in June there. Well, this is the last Thursday. For some reason, it's almost always the opening Thursday of Summerfest, but not this year.
Yeah, that's interesting. You're right about that, because there's always a buzz at the Bucks area on Summerfest yep. when that's going on. I remember hearing about John Henson getting drafted while sitting on the lawn seating of the Marcus Amphitheater. So there's, usually a connection. Well, JP, thanks for joining me. We will talk again next week, and enjoy the remainder of your busy 2 weeks.
Ciao, amigo. See you later.